are eager to visit to say hello, others to say goodbye. Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, after months of isolation, you can now visit your loved ones in extended care and senior facilities in Florida. We'll have a look at the new rules. Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Then later, smart guidance for cities on removing monuments to the Confederacy. But first this hour, the latest on the COVID crisis by the numbers. Statewide, the Department of Health reports an increase of 2,402 cases overnight. And there are now more than 11,500 deaths of Florida residents from the coronavirus, with 465 reported deaths here in Northeast Florida. Even though the death toll has been horrible in this state, there is a silver lining this week to talk about. Declining positive case trend lines mean that some long-term care facilities in Florida will be able to open their doors for visitors as soon as today. On Tuesday, Governor DeSantis came to town to announce that his task force on the safe and limited reopening of long-term care facilities has given him some new recommendations that he is now signing into law. Now, in order for a long-term care facility to qualify in allowing visitors back in again, they need to have had at least 2 weeks without any new coronavirus cases among their residents or their staff. Visitations are by appointment only, and when you get to your loved one's facility, you will have to go through a screening process that includes a temperature check. We're taking a closer look now as we welcome back to the show Marty Goetz, CEO of River Garden Senior Services in Jacksonville. Hi, Marty.
Hi. How are you, Melissa?
I'm great. Good to have you back. Also joining us, Jacksonville attorney Steve Wattrell, who specializes in issues around seniors and long-term care facilities. Hi, Steve.
How are you doing, Melissa? Thank you for having me.
Great. And give us a call, everyone, as we talk about the new rules for visiting your loved ones in Florida's long-term and senior care facilities. Thousands and thousands of families have been suffering in the pandemic around this problem. And of course, it was to keep everyone safe. But we're talking about the new rules. So call us up with your questions. It's 549-2937. Emails to First Coast Connect at wjct.org and tweets to at Melissa in Jax or weigh in on Facebook. So, Marty Goetz, let's begin with you. You're at River Garden Senior Services in Mandarin. You've been subject to the limitations, of course, for months now. With the governor coming to town Tuesday and saying that he's slowly easing up on these restrictions, what does it mean for a facility like River Garden?
Melissa, thank you again for inviting me back. So, first, compassionate visitation, which is discussed in the revised emergency rule, was always in the governor's original emergency order around facility. And we have been using it, albeit sparingly, here at River Garden. So I watched the governor's press conference last week at Eldersauce. He was about 2 miles from River Garden. The governor talked about feeling a pit in his stomach last March as he ordered nursing homes to begin banning visitation. I hope Governor DeSantis felt that same pit in his stomach when he refused to order mandatory wearing of masks in Florida. Because absent a vaccine, masks, social distancing, and hand washing remain the three most effective tools available to us. That has not changed. As far as the governor's revision, I was expecting that he would be including testing. Because testing in communities such as mine are the only way you can get ahead of this fire. Otherwise, you're just chasing it.
You mean a more widespread testing of the general population in addition to testing inside facilities?
No, nursing home staff and contractors, since earlier in this pandemic, have been required to test at least every 14 days. And all of us have been doing that. The CDC recently came out with new guidance, which everybody has now had to incorporate, which is requiring testing of nursing home staff anywhere from twice a week to once a month. And that variability is based upon the positivity rate in the county in which the nursing homes are located. And this is now national policy. So for an organization like River Garden, testing is going to go from once every 14 days to once a week. At least for the immediate future, that will be the case, potentially more often. That's where we are now. The one person that was missing at the governor's press conference was Surgeon General Scott Risky. He's the only medical professional on that task force. I would wonder why he wasn't there at the governor's press conference. He also was the only one at that task force meeting that voiced an objection to not requiring visitors to be tested just as staff are when they come into the nursing facility. They left that as a facility policy issue as opposed to a mandate. I would have strongly disagreed with that position as Secretary Risky did.
And let's talk about that task force, because included in the governor's task force on reopening long-term care facilities is a woman named Mary Daniel. She lives in Jacksonville, Steve, and she made national headlines because she actually took a job as a dishwasher so that she could see her husband at his long-term care facility. She's resigning now that the restrictions are easing up, but she said she just wanted to be able to hold her husband's hand as he gets nearer the end of his life. She pointed out that hundreds of thousands of caregivers just want to be with their families because for so many Florida families, these restrictions easing up mean that they can just go in and say goodbye to a loved one who may be sick or dying. So as you specialize in legal issues around this huge situation in Florida, because of course we have a lot of senior citizens here, what are the most important things families should know about all of this right now?
Well, they have to understand, and talking with what Mr. Goetz was covering, is that if the facilities require these individuals to undergo COVID testing before entering the facility, that's something that they'd have to comply with. I mean, there's different categories. I'm reading the governor's executive order here. We have essential caregivers, which are providing activities of daily living. We have compassionate caregivers, which have their own definition, which is emotional support to help a resident deal with end of life or a difficult transition or loss. And then we have general visitors. And I think it's important that folks that have residents in facilities become very familiar with this so they understand what is required. I mean, you're still going to have to wear a mask. You're going to have to sign in. You're going to have to schedule appointments. There's a lot of things that have to be done. And I think if both sides, both the facilities and these visitors or caregivers comply, I feel like, you know, this can be safely done if everybody sort of plays by the rules. So, but I think it's an important first step. I mean, I understand the facility's position. This is a population that has been disproportionately affected by the COVID pandemic, and they have a duty to protect the residents. And so, but by the same token, it's been 6 months since any of these individuals could really come in and see their loved ones, unless it's an end-of-life issue or something like that, which is not always the case. So I think the governor here was trying to strike a balance. And, you know, with everything else right now, there's a risk. It's like when you go to the gym or a restaurant or somewhere, there is a risk that comes with that. And here, I believe if family members feel like the risk is too great, they don't need to visit. It's not required. But if they want to, there is a protocol here that has to be followed that the facility will follow as well. And I feel like that should adequately protect the residents. Will there be issues? Possibly. But we see there's issues without the family members there because the caregivers or the employees generally are the ones bringing the disease into the facility. So I feel as if everybody plays by the rules and acts in good faith and, you know, doesn't get excited one way or the other about wearing a mask or following the rules, I feel like this could be implemented properly.
Mm-hmm. And as we talk with attorney Steve Wattrell and Marty Goetz, CEO at River Garden Senior Services, we're talking about new rules for visiting your loved ones in a senior or long-term care facility. The governor announced those at an event in Jacksonville Tuesday. You can connect with us on the phone. It's 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org and tweets to @MelissaInJax. And Marty, on our Facebook page, Robert writes, I have several friends who work at different long-term care facilities, and they say most of the infections are from staff. Well, that stands to reason, doesn't it, Marty? Staff are out and about in the community and much more likely to bring COVID into a facility than seniors who are essentially, they've been isolated inside these facilities for 6 months now. And, you know, I'm curious to ask you, what's that isolation been like at River Garden? It's been so tough, we've heard, for folks that are in this situation. They can't see their loved ones. They can't see their friends. The social isolation has just been devastating, hasn't it?
So to answer the Facebook writer, yes, it's the case that staff have been the ones coming and going. Residents, for the most part, are isolated on the campus. To expect that staff who live in the community would have a significantly different experience around positivity than the general community. That's why the county's positivity rate is so important, is probably delusional. It's wishful thinking. People don't, when they go home at night, they're not living in a bubble. And that's why testing has been so important. I will tell you that in our experience at River Garden, the overwhelming majority of positive staff tests we've had have been of asymptomatic individuals. I can also tell you that all of our care staff have been wearing proper PPE, and in most cases it would be N95 masks while providing care. And that makes a huge, huge difference. To the question about the isolation, you're absolutely correct. It's been devastating. This campus is, for the most part, like a ghost town. We have an independent living facility, the Coves, which is adjacent to our nursing center, and even those folks can't come into River Garden. Now, the flip to that is our staff have been extraordinary in connecting families to residents. We've leveraged technology to the hilt. We have Zoom accounts, we have Facebook, we have Skype, we've got iPads all over the place, and we've been using them to very good effect. We also initiated porch visits, which allows residents and families to get together under a supervised visit for a period of time, and those have been to good effect. But the reality is none of it substitutes for a loved one being able to come into the nursing home, sit down and spend time, quality time, with their loved one. No question about it.
Yeah, that is absolutely right. Now, as you point out, the protocol is being observed perfectly at your facility, River Garden. Steve Wattrell, what if someone out there listening is concerned that maybe they have a loved one in a facility that isn't as well managed and that they could potentially be at risk now that the restrictions are easing up a little bit around COVID? What advice do you have there?
Well, I mean, I would very quickly get an understanding of the facility's protocols for allowing the caregivers and the general visitors to visit. I know some facilities with general visitors, they can just visit outside, so they have set up areas where you can, you know, visit outdoors, which would not, you know, really put other residents at risk. So I would very quickly figure out how are you going to be allowing these visitors in your facility, and are they going to be going on to the units where my loved one is? And if the answer is, well, they're not going to be anywhere near there, then I don't think the concern is great. However, if they're going to allow compassionate caregivers into the same room as your loved one, that could be of concern. And so, again, you need to very quickly figure out what the facility's protocols are going to be in terms of requiring PPE, the temperature checks, hand sanitizer, distancing, et cetera, et cetera. you know, and there's a risk to all this. There's no doubt, as Marty pointed out. I mean, there is going to be risk in allowing people in the facilities. But again, if these protocols are followed, I feel like it is a good first step, and it can be safely done if everybody plays by the rules.
Right. That's the thing, Marty, because if people don't follow the rules, we could be shutting back down again this fall, particularly if we have an active flu season. How concerned are you about that?
You know, Melissa, early on in this pandemic, one of the things I said to everyone on this campus, both in the nursing center, the families, and at the Cove, our independent living facility, is that my job now is not to make you happy. My job now is to keep you alive. And that's been what we have been singularly focused on since the middle of March, when all of this craziness started. We have stayed focused on that. So our intention, as we begin to allow visitation on the campus, which clearly I support, if needed, is to hold visitors to the exact same standards that we hold our staff to when they are with residents. And that is testing, that's proper PPE in use at the time of their visit, and of course, privacy.
Yeah. All right. Let's go to some calls now as we talk about new rules in Florida with the slow but steady decline in positive COVID cases. That means if you've got grandma or dad or any senior in your life in a facility that you've been unable to visit them for months now, with some restrictions, you can visit them. Doris is on the line in Jacksonville. Hi, Doris. Good morning. Hi, Doris. You're on the air.
Hello, hello.
Hi, is this Doris?
Hello, hello.
It says Doris.
No, can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, this is Chuck from the beach.
Chuck, okay. Go ahead, Chuck.
Yes, ma'am. Okay, so your guest earlier, and I agree with everything he said. I have no problems with anything he said. I have on two masks at the moment, and I just left a big Home Depot. He said that they should make it a law. It is a law in Duval County, if I understand.
The mask mandate, yeah, it is.
Yes.
An ordinance, yeah.
And I just left Home Depot, and for every 10 customers in there, only 9 were wearing masks. So it is a law, and so unless you start arresting people or fining them, other than what we're doing right now, it's not. So my point is this. The general public in general is not concerned. They don't understand that they can get it and take it home to their mama or their wife. The general public just doesn't get it. And I don't know what you can do about it. It's a law in Duval County, but for whatever reason, and I've had two people tell me that after November the 4th, it won't be a problem anymore, as if it's just big fake news.
They think so, after the election, it'll just go away. They think it's all a hoax.
It's all a hoax.
Yeah.
If you go into any big store and walk around, there's a big sign on the door. It says mandatory masks. And they're in Home Depot, and they're not wearing them.
I know it, Chuck. And I thank you for the call. And thanks for wearing yours. Thank you. Okay, let's speak. Go ahead, Marty, and then Steve. Yeah, go ahead.
If I could just comment on what Chuck said, because I understand what he's saying. You know, leadership counts. And I think when the history of this pandemic is eventually written, it's going to be a scathing indictment on leadership. The governor, the virus is not political. It doesn't know county lines or state boundaries. The governor needed to have mandated mask wearing, and the president needed to have mandated mask wearing, and they needed to have taken their lead from the CDC, which from the very beginning, almost from the very beginning, called for wearing of masks. That's been the single most significant failure in leadership.
Thanks for that, Marty. And certainly epidemiologists and public health experts around the world agree with you. Steve Wattrell, what about the fact that we don't have a statewide mask mandate, as Marty pointed out? It would have helped bring down the cases sooner. This isn't a hoax. It's a real pandemic. It's not a political tactic to favor one candidate or the other. The virus doesn't discriminate. It will infect all of us, no matter what our political persuasion. But what about the fact that, as that caller pointed out, yes, we have a mask mandate in Duval, and credit goes to Mayor Curry for putting one into effect, but it doesn't have legal teeth. You can't really be fined or punished if you don't follow the mandate. We're really all on the honor system here for the most part in trying to bring down these numbers by wearing masks.
Well, this is a different situation. This is a situation where we have the frailest of the frail, the population most greatly affected by the pandemic, and it's real simple. This order says the visitor shall. They shall wear a surgical mask and PPE as appropriate. So if people want to come in and argue politics, then they won't be able to visit their loved ones. This is not, you know, we're not playing a game with the lives of our seniors here. If people want to play politics, then they won't be able to visit. This is, the governor did this, and this is based on the task force, and we could look at the politics of it, but at the end of the day, you have to follow the rules if you want visitation, because you will put other people at risk. And why would you want to do that? I mean, I would find something wrong with somebody who wouldn't want to comply by the rules to make these seniors safe. I mean, that's just common sense and decency.
Yeah.
Anybody who doesn't agree with that, I don't think should be visiting nursing homes.
Great point. On Facebook, a listener writes, "We lost my mom to COVID Saturday night. Her death was completely unnecessary. It was brought on by people who brought the virus into her nursing home and infected her through their carelessness. Please wear your mask, wash your hands, and socially distance. Do it to protect our seniors, our weak ones, and those we love dearly." Thanks for that comment. Marty Goetz, your final thoughts for everybody as you slowly begin to reopen River Garden.
We are going to remain focused, strongly focused on wearing a facial mask, keeping people properly distanced, and disinfection. And as soon as there is an approved vaccine available, I expect that the CDC will send it to nursing facilities assisting high-risk populations. We've been told that will occur, and we would look for everybody to become vaccinated. This virus, we can do better. Even now, we can do better. We need leadership, and that starts at the top. And that's when you will get a higher compliance in the wearing of masks. It is a fact, Melissa, that in those states where the governors, Republican or Democratic governors, have come out strongly telling people you've got to wear a mask, you've got to be responsible as communities, they have had much better outcomes than those states that have not. I'm very disappointed that leadership has failed in this area. I really am.
Thank you for those thoughts. He's Marty Goetz, CEO of River Garden Senior Services in Mandarin, and Jacksonville attorney Steve Wattrell, who specializes in senior and long-term care facility matters. Gentlemen, thank you both so much for being with us.
Thank you, Melissa.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Great to have you both, and much more still ahead. Later, it's been tough for the restaurant industry in this pandemic, but Jacksonville chef Dennis Chan is a happy warrior. We'll check in as he builds his dream restaurant, even in the midst of all this. But up next.
There are lots of different ways to go about dealing with this issue. One school of thought is to take the statues down altogether, and then the question is, what do you do with them?
The smart way to remove monuments to the old Confederacy. That's after this. It's the biggest stories affecting the Sunshine State. Hi, I'm Melissa Ross.
And I'm Tom Hudson. Join us Friday for the Florida Roundup.
Each week at noon, we interview newsmakers and people from across the state discussing the stories and issues that affect your life. What's driving the conversation in Florida?
Join the conversation on the Florida Roundup.
Every Friday at noon on WJCT News 89.9. Welcome back. Well, in recent months, cities like Jacksonville and St. Augustine have finally been getting down to the business of removing monuments and markers to the Confederacy. Cities have really struggled with how to go about this, and they've not always had agreement about what to do with the monuments and statues once they come down. Attorney, architect, and historic preservationist Sarah Bronin is studying this issue and has a look at it now for us. I spoke with her. Sarah, good to talk to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And of course, the topic of monument or statue removal is an incredibly hot topic, both in our area and in many spots around the country, with the removal of the Confederate statue in Jacksonville's downtown Johnson Park. It actually used to be named Hemming Park, but they changed the name of the park too. And in St. Augustine, where a Confederate memorial is being removed, and there's a discussion about where it will be placed once it's removed. And so you study this, and you've looked at how we should best memorialize history. So as we take these monuments down, what do you think is the right way to go about this so that we pay proper honor to people who've been marginalized by history, and we put history in its proper context?
Well, communities all over the country are grappling with exactly this question. What do we do with monuments to events or people that may have had the effect in their lifetimes, or the event might have had the effect of contributing to marginalization of certain people? So, you know, the communities that you're in now are certainly not alone. There are lots of different ways to go about dealing with this issue. So one school of thought, and we're seeing a lot of that in recent months, is to take the statues down altogether. And then the question is, what do you do with them? Do you put them in a warehouse, as some communities have done? Do you sell them at an auction, as other communities have done? Or do you gather up all of these offensive statues and put them in a museum? Not a lot of museums will want to take them, but that's another option too.
Yeah.
And I guess the other part, oh, go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was going to say the other part of your question is, well, what goes in their place? You know, a lot of these have, these monuments have pedestals, or they serve as focal points for city hall plazas or boulevards. And so what do you put in their place? And I think that's a question that that communities can start to ask themselves now. What other parts of our history have not been memorialized and have not been honored? And how do we then go about replacing these statues with a more inclusive view of what history is?
And there are places like that around the country. The National Memorial for Peace and Justice in Montgomery, Alabama. There's a memorial to enslaved laborers in Charlottesville, Virginia, other things like that. How important do you think these sites are now to better contextualize and educate people about our history?
So the interesting thing about both of the sites you mentioned is that they are not like the statues that many communities have been taking down. They don't represent a single person. They're not figural. Instead, they're abstract. They use modernistic or abstract forms to communicate history. And if they reference specific people, which both of those do, it's in subtle ways. The lettering is small. The memorials are comprised of a composite of different people whose names we have forgotten, unlike some of the people whose figural statues have been torn down. So I think what's really interesting about both of those that you mentioned are that they've started to bring us to a point where they take a viewer to a point of almost of abstraction in trying to imagine the injustice that has befallen both of the groups, those individuals who were lynched, those individuals who were enslaved, and bring us to a point of understanding in a way that's very different from viewing a statue of a person.
What would you say to those who disagreed with monument removals? And certainly it's been incredibly controversial and sometimes has led to deadly violence. What's your response to those who think that too much is being made out of this, that they are simply statuary, and that it's not an important issue to them, or they're even hostile and offended by the idea of taking down some of these monuments?
Well, I think for those people who have objected to taking down certain monuments that other people find offensive, I would suggest that they look at the history of the statues themselves. When were they put up and why? And they will find that in many cases these statues were put up at certain points when the dominant group, you know, predominantly whites, were intending to use the statues as a way to express their dominance over other groups. And if you look, you know, during the Jim Crow era, during the 1950s, during the 1920s as well, all of these times were moments in our history where we saw a lot of these statues, particularly Confederate statues, be erected. And those all came at points of racial tension and stress. So the reason for the statues was not to commemorate an immediate past. The Civil War wasn't the immediate past when we got into the middle of the 20th century, but it was rather to convey a dominance. And the motivation for them, you know, you have to look at that and think whose history was purporting to be portrayed and why. And I think that mm-hmm. makes the difference between looking at a statue of someone who played a role in a dominant history versus looking at something where history itself happened. The statues are later memorializations of events.
Why do you think it's taken so long for America to have this reckoning, to really come to terms with the ugliness of our past and clear away all of the denial and misinformation and false narratives about why these monuments were erected and just the ugliness of the oppression of people that suffered under the societies that saw fit to put them up? Why do you think it's taken us so long to deal with this?
Well, I think you can say with certainty that it will continue to take time to deal with this. I wouldn't say that our reckoning is over. It's true that we have many cities and towns whose leaders and whose people have decided to remove offensive statues and have understood the impact of their existence on people who are looking at them. But we have many, many communities and many places and many leaders who have not come to that understanding. So I would maybe rephrase your question to say, you know, how much longer will this be? You know, it's a source of frustration to think that there are so many of these monuments still up, and so many of our young children, boys and girls, who pass them every day, and when they understand what they mean, it becomes very painful.
Yeah, the national organization TakeItDown.org is actually based here in Jacksonville. They're working to take down monuments to the Confederacy all over the country. And I think what surprises people, Sarah, is that many of these are in the North. They're not all in the South, right?
Yeah, so there are certainly a lot of statues, even in the North. I think there was one. You know, there's a couple even up here in New England where I'm sitting today, although none in Connecticut that I know of. So it's true, you know, hatred and racism can exist anywhere, and no one is immune to that. It's unfortunate, though, that some of these monuments to that feeling still continue to exist all over the country and not just in what we might consider the hotbed of you know, that the former nostalgia about the former Confederacy.
Do you think there should be a playbook for cities? Because different municipalities have dealt with this in different ways, and it's a difficult thing to do. I mean, in Jacksonville, they took down the Confederate statue in the downtown, it's now Johnson Park, the former Heming Park, in the middle of the night, so as to avoid violence, really.
The interesting thing about a playbook idea is that it would really have to be a playbook for each state, because different states actually have laws that prevent, some states actually have laws that prevent local governments from taking down public statues related to wars, and that includes the Civil War, and it encompasses Confederate statues too. And these state laws differ from one state to the next. The penalties differ from one state to the next. Sometimes, as in Alabama, you might just have to pay a $25,000 fee to the state if you're a local government that has determined that taking down a statue is the right thing to do. In other states, it's completely prohibited. So you kind of have to have a state-by-state playbook, which takes into account different rules that have been passed, some very recently, including in Alabama, the Memorial Preservation Act was passed within the last few years. But others of these laws were passed, much longer ago. And so you kind of have to look at all of those before you give any one town or any one community a playbook. There's certainly not a national approach to this, although perhaps there should be.
That's an important point. Well, it's great to get your insights on this. She's Sarah Bronin, attorney, architect, and historic preservation expert, as we talk about monument removal. Sarah, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, owning and running a restaurant has proven incredibly challenging for thousands of restaurant owners across the country during this pandemic. But imagine trying to open up a new restaurant in this time. If there's anyone who can do that, it's Chef Dennis Chan of Blue Bamboo, one of the best places in town. Chef Dennis is on the line now to tell us how things are going at Blue Bamboo as he prepares to open up his new dream restaurant. Hey, Chef Dennis, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
It's so good to have you on the show. Now, of course, the pandemic has been tough on all of us, but especially locally owned restaurants. I encourage everyone to support their locally owned restaurants as much as they possibly can right now with in dining and takeout. What's happening with Blue Bamboo? You bought a new property that you're planning to open in the holiday season this year, correct?
Yes, we will be open by the end of the year, and it's being built now, and the contractors tell me we'll be done in time to open for the holidays.
Wow. Now, you had originally intended, right, to keep your original location on Southside Boulevard open as well, but with COVID-19, you've had to make some tough decisions like everyone else. So is everything moving over to Mandarin?
We will move our entire operations over to Mandarin. You know, when COVID first happened, we had to pivot like most businesses did, and we did cooking classes virtually. We did a lot of takeout, and we're really blessed because we didn't have to lay off anybody. We kept our team together. We kept everyone safe, and so we you know, a few months ago we said, well, you know, what's our decision? Do we continue and try to operate too, or do we give our all to our new venture? And so the decision was made to give our all to our new venture, and we're very excited about the possibilities.
Now, you've made some changes to the design of the new space just to be mindful of the COVID time we're in. What are some of the changes diners will notice?
Well, one of the blessings that we have is the blessing of space. So our tables are able to be socially distant. So each table can be spaced 6 feet apart. Some of the hand washing facilities and the bathrooms, we've gone to touchless hand washing and drying and soap. So we've just
Oh, we lost you there, Dennis. Are you still with us? I think he was just saying that they've added touchless sinks, soap dispensers and hand dryers, partitions between tables to keep people separated. Those kinds of things, you know, are what restaurants are having to do. I think we lost the connection. So Chef Dennis, give us a call back as we talk about what's happening with restaurants in this time of COVID. Blue Bamboo owner Chef Dennis Chan is a familiar face around town. He is one of the best chefs and restaurateurs in the region. And what he is doing, just to bring you up to date, is he's closing his original location at 3820 Southside Boulevard. That's at Beach and Southside, consolidating all of his operations and his nearly two dozen staffers to a new location in Mandarin, where he's going to hire even more people. We have Chef Dennis back on the line. Chef Dennis.
I'm here.
Hey. You know,
all I had to do was talk about COVID and then...
And then everything fell apart, I know.
Yes.
I know. So this year has been so tough on the local restaurant community and restaurants nationwide. How have you gotten through it?
Well, you know, we're really thankful for our regular guests and the support that they've given us. They've really supported us through takeout. They've supported us through attending our virtual cooking classes. And, you know, they've been so generous with our staff, too, when they come in for either takeout or when they come in for dinner or lunch. And so, you know, we're thankful for that. And, you know, we hope that will carry over to our new location.
Yeah, absolutely right, because this is a time when we need to support independently owned restaurants now more than ever. Now, your restaurant is known for what you call hip Asian comfort food. I freely admit my bias. I'm a big fan. Will the new menu in Mandarin, will there be any changes to what diners can enjoy?
We are also adding a few, you know, my family's been in the restaurant business here in town for decades. And so we are going to incorporate even more of those items that my family's known for, you know, in our restaurants over the decades. So a lot more Cantonese, Chinese focus than what we've done at Blue Bamboo at our original location.
Why'd you make that change?
We've had so many of our regular customers ask for more and more of that over the years. And so I think the time's right to, you know, be a little bit more nostalgic. And that's comfort food. In the time of COVID, that's what our customers are asking for.
I think that's so revealing. Yeah, we want comfort food right now more than ever. And as we come through this crisis, how do you think the restaurant business will change? What do you think will be some of the long-term changes we see out of this pandemic?
Well, we've been very lucky to be able to change our design just to make people feel more comfortable when they come dine with us. I think that going forward is going to be one of the big design elements of all restaurants. I think that a lot of restaurants now have a lot more of a takeout focus. And we've always, you know, even in our design stages before COVID, we had planned on having an area dedicated to takeout. And, you know, having COVID happen kind of reinforced some of those decisions that we made even before the pandemic hit.
Well, everyone, check out Blue Bamboo. In the winter, they will have their new location in Mandarin. You can still support them for now on Southside Boulevard, and he is Chef Dennis Chan. Dennis, thanks so much, and best of luck.
Thanks so much, Melissa.
We'll be right back.
This message is brought to you by the Florida Division of Emergency Management, Florida Public Media, and this radio station.
This is Craig Fugate, the former director of Florida Emergency Management. In this time of COVID, you need to update your hurricane preparedness plan. That means knowing what evacuation zone you live in, and if ordered to leave, you need to go. Take your pets and stay with family or friends, or at an inland hotel. Shelters are another option. Know your zone, know your home. For more information, go to floridastorms.org. That's floridastorms.org.
With so many office buildings closed for the foreseeable future, a whole lot of eateries that rely on the office lunch crowd are struggling.
New York is being emptied out, and you can feel it at the store level.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. How some Manhattan food joints are trying to make it through. Next time on Marketplace.
Tonight at 6, here on WJCT News 89.9.
Some people applaud her work as First Lady, Senator, and Secretary of State, while others focus on Benghazi and those emails. Michael D'Antonio joins us to talk about his research into how one woman became a symbolic cudgel for modern politics. His new book is called The Hunting of Hillary, the 40-year campaign to destroy Hillary Clinton. That's next time on Think. Tonight at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
More Americans than ever have been freed from the daily commute, but are we any more productive working from home? Americans can seem driven to always do more, but does that take away from the work that matters most? This moment has brought renewed attention on what we've neglected to care for and repair. How unproductive is the urge to be so productive? That's next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10, here on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, the COVID pandemic has unfortunately taken the focus off other health issues for millions of us. But if there's one thing we've learned in this crisis, it's how important it is to maintain your health. That means making time for early detection screenings for breast cancer and other illnesses. Dr. Smita Sharma is chief of women's imaging with the UF College of Medicine at UF Health Jacksonville. Dr. Sharma, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
You know, there's so much focus right now, obviously, on the pandemic, but other medical issues are important to talk about, particularly your field, the importance of early detection, screening for mammography. There is some new technology and imaging centers at UF Health Jax as well. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that's correct, Melissa. You're right. There is a lot going on with the pandemic, and it is an environment where, you know, we still need to just keep following the advice of the experts and keep ourselves safe and everybody around us safe. At the same time, it's important to note that, unfortunately, cancers and other medical conditions have not taken a backseat. So I want to remind all women about the importance of screening mammography, because this also is, you know, a potentially life-saving exam and may save your life or the life of a loved one. Now, regarding our centers in UF Jacksonville, we currently do have 5 imaging centers in different parts of the city, so people can go to the location that is most convenient to them. But I do want to talk about the 2 new imaging centers that we have and the technology being offered there. So the UF Health Bay Meadows is our new center, which is located on Phillips Highway. And here we do 3D imaging. We do 3D imaging in all of our centers. But in addition to the 3D mammography that we have in Bay Meadows, we have a newer technology, which is the first FDA-cleared 3D mammography artificial intelligence software. So this basically can evaluate each 3D mammogram image for any abnormality, and it can further improve the benefits of 3D mammography. So that means a more improved cancer detection rate and significantly reduced false positives. So we have to call fewer women back for, you know, unnecessary testing, which can be very stressful and inconvenient for women.
Sure. Okay, so 2 new imaging centers, UF Bay Meadows and UF Wildlight. And the technology you're using is certainly cutting edge. Now, going beyond that, and, you know, it is so important that we manage our health in this time, and this is part of it for women. Just getting those preventative screenings, so important to not fall off on that right now. Now, at the same time, whenever we have a medical professional on, I ask them about safety measures that are being taken at their hospital system to protect patients and staff from COVID-19. Can you bring us up to date on the situation at UF Health Jacksonville?
Yes, definitely. So it's understandable. People are very nervous about going to the hospitals or any kind of setting like that because we know how contagious this virus is. So at UF Health Jacksonville, we are, you know, taking a lot of enhanced safety measures to protect our patients and employees. All of our facilities have the mandatory face mask coverings in place. And before entering the building, all patients and visitors are screened. And once they're in the building, the waiting areas and the check-in areas are not crowded. So we follow the CDC guidelines of social distancing, and all of the equipment is very well sanitized, cleaned, and wiped, you know, before imaging each patient. So we are very committed to keeping everybody safe, and you can be reassured that you will be safe when you come for any kind of services that we offer here.
Well, thank you, Doctor. Dr. Smita Sharma, Chief of Women's Imaging at UF College of Medicine, UF Health Jacksonville. Thanks so much, and be safe.
Thank you, Melissa. You too. Thank you so much.
And more cancer prevention news, this from today's TU. Jacksonville's Acosta Bridge is going for the gold this week to support National Childhood Cancer Awareness Month. They're going to use new LED accent lighting to create a golden glow on the bridge. This is an initiative by the Tom Coughlin J Fund Foundation to help local families tackle childhood cancer. Now, some other downtown buildings will also get in on this and be bathed in golden light. This is really neat. So, you know, take a little bit of time this week to come check out the Acosta Bridge. It will be gold to highlight National Childhood Cancer Awareness Month. Daly's Place will be lit in gold as well all month long. And some other locations around town that you will notice we'll be doing this. The J Fund Foundation and its community supporters in New York and Jacksonville have provided about $13 million in financial assistance to families affected by childhood cancer. It's tcjfund.org for more about this. And what a great effort. That's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Josh Torres is show director. Our news director is Jessica Palumbo. And Bill Bortsfield is our digital editor. Have questions or comments? Keep those emails coming to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And if you missed anything from today's show, catch our rebroadcast tonight at 8 o'clock, or our podcast will be up later today, wherever you get yours. I'm Melissa Ross. Have a great Thursday. We'll be back here again to connect with you at 9 a.m. tomorrow.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.